Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Know the drill, we're recording on Tuesday morning. So I've been thinking a lot about the abortion issue. Obviously, since Dobbs, we're all terrified. We've seen the overturning of Roe v. Wade. We're now seeing just the most incredible extreme agendas happening in most of the MAGA-controlled states. I saw a story at the beginning of the year that I don't think has gotten enough attention, and I want to emphasize this story for you. And it's about the constitutional protections for abortion that now has come to France. So I'm going to read you the opening couple of sentences from a New York Times article. Here's the headline. French lawmakers enshrine access to abortion in constitution. Legislators pass an amendment giving women the guaranteed freedom to end their pregnancies, which experts called a global first. Now, let me read from the New York Times article. French legislators on Monday, this is sometime in February, voted to explicitly enshrine access to abortion in the Constitution, making their country the first in the world to do so. Acutely aware that they were breaking historical ground from the Grand Assembly Room inside Versailles Palace, the politicians delivered impassioned speeches about women's rights around the world, paid homage to the courageous French women who had fought for abortion rights when it was illegal, and leaped up time and again to offer standing ovations. We are sending the message to all women, your body belongs to you, and no one has the right to control it in your stead, said Prime Minister Gabriel Attal. And then before the gathered lawmakers, they voted, ready for the vote, everyone? 780 to 72 for the amendment. The amendment declares abortion to be a guaranteed freedom overseen by the parliament's laws. That means future governments will not be able to drastically modify the current laws funding abortion for women who seek one up to 14 weeks into their pregnancies, according to the French justice minister. And they go on and on and on. But this is the line I absolutely love, and it's the line I'm going to take with me in my head and in my heart as I approach the November election. France is showing the right to an abortion is no longer an option. It is a condition of our democracy. Let me read that quote again. France is showing the right to abortion is no longer an option. It is a condition of our democracy. Anyway, if you haven't been following what's been going on in France, hold that in your head as you vote in 2024. All right, part one. We're going to be rejoined by a guest we've had a couple of times over the course of 2023. We needed to invite him back. Elliot Haspel is a nationally recognized child and family policy expert and commentator. He has a specialty in early childhood and education issues. He is the author of Crawling Behind, America's Childcare Crisis and How to Fix It. And he's a senior fellow at the think tank Capita. He's appeared on television as an analyst on PBS, yada, yada, yada. And he also writes a semi-monthly newsletter, The Parents Aren't All Right. And the reason, Elliot, I've been thinking a lot about you is I just mentioned I started the show by talking about France. So where am I going after I think about France? I go to Canada, our northern neighbor. And it was as a result of having interviewed you months ago that I learned about what the Canadians were doing. And what I learned was that the Canadians were rolling out a $10 a day childcare policy. And back sometime in, I think early January, maybe December, there was a piece at Vox.com where you were highly quoted. And it was entitled, Canada is promoting childcare for $10 a day. Could it work in the US? So one, I want to welcome you back to the program. And then I want you to explain to my audience exactly what the Canadians are doing, how they got to this point. Are they really at the point of $10 a day, or is that sort of the dream going forward into the future? But I think what's also important is, and I'm going to be very personal here, my daughter has a three-year-old. She is a single parent. She lives in rural Vermont, and the cost of her childcare per week is $400 a week. Now, the good news is she's no longer a para in an educational system, Elliot. She finally got accepted for her certification because she's taught all over the world for over a decade, but somehow getting certified as a teacher in the U.S. was an incredible climb. Well, now she is a certified teacher, which means her para wages have almost tripled. But even at tripled, $400 a week is astronomical. It is astronomical. It is more than her rent. It is more than so many of the bills that she pays. And yet you want her to participate in the workforce. You want her to be able to pay her bills in a timely fashion. And frankly, from an employer's perspective, we have to lower the cost. And from a family perspective, we have to lower the cost. So let me welcome you back to the program and talk to me a little bit about what you have studied over the course of these last couple of years and how we can look at what Canada is doing, which is actually modeling after a number of countries in Europe, but why the Canadians were finally able to get close to goal and why this is actually essential for America. So welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me in it. I appreciate you sharing that story. And it's true for so many families in America. Child care is a backbreaking cost that restricts their flourishing, restricts their freedom, where to live, where they want to work, what they want to do, how many kids to have. I know it's truly, it hurts community vibrancy. It hurts everyone, even folks who don't have kids would benefit from there being a strong child care system. So I absolutely agree with you. The American childcare system is deeply broken. What Canada has been doing, as you mentioned, is rolling out this $10 a day childcare system. And this has been a long time coming. So Quebec in the late 90s started a deeply subsidized childcare system using a lot of public dollars. British Columbia followed about 10 years later. And they've just been building and building and building. But then a few years back, the Trudeau government announced this national commitment, and basically they committed $30 billion in federal Canadian money over 5 years. And Canada is about 10% the population of the U.S. So that would be, you know, like the U.S. putting in around $250 or $300 billion right. into child care over 5 years. To give you a sense of what we put in right now, it's about $30 billion a year. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge increase in public funding. Now, I know that was matched. Provinces also put in a lot of money as well. And what this money is being used to do is a couple of things. One is it is going directly to childcare programs. So the childcare program to cover their costs. So if you're a childcare program, right, if Arnie is starting your Arnie's childcare center, you have a lot of costs that come from staff in particular, right? You have to have very low child to adult ratios because you want to keep those kids safe and you want to make sure that you can give them the care and the learning opportunities that they deserve. So personnel costs are extremely high. You know, you've got to pay maintenance, you got to pay for your building, you've got to pay all these things. And because it's so expensive, and because there previously wasn't a lot of public money, the only places that these childcare programs could turn was parents. So that's why your daughter is paying $400 a week, right? Because, and which comes out to right, like some $15,000+ a year.
And that's after tax dollars. Those are after tax dollars. Think about this, everyone. So now you're paying your FICA, you're paying your taxes, you're paying your Vermont income tax, your federal income tax, and then you have to come up with the $400. So it's not like it's pre-tax, it's after tax.
Right. And here's the secret, those is that are, like those childcare programs are not making bank off of that money. They need to be charging more because it's extraordinarily expensive. It should be expensive. Some things in life are expensive. If you mentioned, you know, public schools, if we asked parents to pick up the per pupil, you know, amount, which is about $14,000 as a national average, you know, that would be a huge problem. So, but without that public money, that's why it's such an expensive service for parents and why childcare educators are paid so little. So what Canada did, to your point, following up some other countries, is they said, we're going to start having public money take over a large amount of those operational costs. And as a result, these programs don't have to charge parents as much. They're actually able to operate a sustainable program without charging parents through the nose. And so $10 a day is the goal. They've reached a few interim steps. So in almost every province, they have now reduced the average fee by half. And in British Columbia, I just saw this came out just the other day. In 2017, the average person in family in British Columbia was paying $50 a day for childcare. So that comes out to, you know, somewhere around $12,000 a year. Right. The average in British Columbia in just 7 years is down to $18 a day.
Oh, my God. I got to interview parents.
You read these articles from the Canadian media, and these parents are like, I got a letter in the mail just saying, like, my bill is going down by like 2/3, and it was life-changing for me. Let me start saving, and let me get that medical procedure I needed to, right? Like, let me fix the car that was making, you know, the strange noise. It was is really meaningful. So, yes, we've seen huge progress. And, you know, we've certainly encountered some challenges, but they're on their way.
So I'm looking at an article that recently came out maybe about 2 weeks ago, and it's about February's Canada child benefit payments are going out tomorrow. Okay. And this is a report from directly from Canada. And what I see is that it is income sensitive. So it isn't that everybody gets the same check. But what I'm reading is the following. The maximum annual benefit per kid under six is $7,437, and the maximum yearly amount per child 6 through 17 is $6,275. But that's because we're still in the same benefit year that we were in the latter half of 2023. So that's a significant amount of money. But I'm hearing a couple things from you. And that is that so this maximum benefit is given to people that are making under like $34,000 a year. Okay, that's not surprising. And that it decreases over the course of your wages increasing. But there are a couple of things that I'm curious about. So that's what I get per year, or in this case, they send me a check per month. But you also mentioned part of this benefit that the Canadians were embracing was a benefit to directly to the child care centers. So is this kind of like a push-pull in the
So it's
sense
actually,
that I'm getting a check to help me pay for my child care, but the child care facility is also getting a check so that they are able to have a robust child care program and do it at a reduced cost.
it's a great point. It's a great question. So we should clarify.
Okay.
Canada has, as some other peer countries have as well, two separate issues, right? So the Canada Child Benefit is sort of the equivalent to the US Child Tax Credit. It's actually
Right.
not intended specifically as a child care policy. It's intended to help families offset the general costs of child rearing, right? You have a baby, you suddenly your budget just went up. You have cost more for food, for clothes,
Okay, okay.
for toys, for all that stuff. And so the Canadian Child Benefit is intended, it's not linked to child care in any way. It's just
Oh,
you get
wow.
that check because Canada, because countries benefit from having strong families and healthy families and strong kids and healthy kids. And it's a burden on a family to have a child because you're increasing your expenses without increasing your income, right? You don't get
Right,
a
right. Okay.
raise at work because you had a kid. So that's the Canada Child Benefit. But you can use that dollar, you can take that money and use it to pay the child care fees, but you don't have to. And
Okay.
then the $10 a day child care system is a specific child care policy. So that is
Okay.
intended to build a system of high quality child care programs, family child care programs in people's houses, child care centers of all different types, what we might call pre-K here. And that's where this $10 a day system is flowing. So it is, in a sense, like, yes, there are multiple levers being pulled, but we should clarify that it's actually a layer of policies in much the way that Canada also has really strong paid family leave, right? Like, we could have that conversation
And
where
they have
you,
universal health care. I mean,
right?
as I'm
So
listening to all
these
these things,
stack, they stack on each other, and they support one another. But yeah, just to clarify, the child benefit is a general child benefit.
Oh,
The
okay.
ten
So,
dollar a
so
day
the
program is child care specific.
now let me understand something. So I'm getting the child benefit, and then I'm getting the daycare benefit. So what is the daycare benefit? Is it universal right now in
Yeah, so this
Canada?
was so
Right.
basically what happened is it's you kind of call it targeted universalism. So
Okay,
that
okay.
it so they first so everyone gets a benefit to their fee reduction. So every program that's participating in this in every province gets some money, and they're able to use that to reduce their fees. Then there's a subset of programs, and they're prioritizing those that focus that serve lower income families, that
Right.
serve indigenous families, other certain populations that have historically been disenfranchised or have higher need. Those childcare programs are entering into contracts with their provinces to reduce their costs even further towards that $10 a day. So you can kind of think of it as like a blanket benefit that everyone's fees are going down by about half. And
Okay.
then slowly they're building up the kind of taking you from there down to the $10 a day, with a priority going to, again, the populations that have the most need first. So that eventually, yes, if you are affluent and you live in Canada, eventually you'll have access to $10 a day childcare, but you're going to be the last ones to get it because you're the last ones who need it.
But because they're investing in the childcare facilities themselves, even the wealthy are seeing a benefit because their childcare costs are going down. They're just not getting a check to actually reduce it even further, but they are seeing some kind of a benefit because they're able to access a lower cost.
Yes, they're seeing
Because,
exactly.
right.
They're seeing some sort of benefit. That's right. Which
All
is
right.
I think one of the reasons it's gotten broad popular support,
Oh,
right?
yeah.
Because
Yeah. I mean,
learned.
that's why I love Social Security. Do me a favor. Don't ever make it income sensitive. I want everybody to get this. I'm sorry. I'm a crazy lady about that. But I have a question for you. So one of the problems we have with childcare in the United States, and I suspect is also true in Canada, is that they pay the workers crap. Okay. So if I want a facility and I want a facility that retains good people, that gets the best, that pays people so that they're not on food stamps or on welfare because they're working 40 or 50 hours a week in a childcare facility. My concern, however, is that if you're channeling all that money into the childcare facility to reduce the per child cost, you're not necessarily raising wages for the people that are working there. So how are the Canadians juggling this three-legged stool? Because it
I
really is a
you
three-legged stool.
it is you'd make a good childcare policy analyst. You're
Oh,
identifying
thank you so much.
all the issues. Yes, so a couple of things. Advocates have been pushing provinces to adopt wage grids for or salary scales, if you want to call them. So again, public school teachers, right? People who work for local government, state government, firefighters, right? All of these are on salary bands. So there's a minimum salary, and then depending on your credentials and your experience, right, you step up like the amount of money you're making. And so eventually the goal is for provinces to adopt those, and then programs would be getting, in the grant that they're getting every year from the government, that's letting them pay those salary bands.
Okay.
That's the goal. In the meantime, there are provinces like British Columbia which are giving direct wage supplements. So they'll basically say, like, we're going, the market is only bearing a $15 an hour wage, so we're going to give the equivalent of a $5 an hour raise to every childcare educator by sending that money again through the programs.
Right.
So there are interim steps being taken, but I will tell you that is the single biggest challenge they're having in Canada right now.
Yes, yes.
Is keeping the program staffed and having enough supply as a result. Because as you can imagine, when you make childcare more accessible and available and affordable, lots of parents want it because there's this pent-up demand. And so, but they're having
Right.
a little bit of trouble reaching that supply. And we've seen this in other countries too, like Germany, where it's one thing to help affordability, but if you aren't investing enough money to really make being a childcare educator a middle class job with family sustaining wages with good benefits, right? That to respect and honor the work that goes into caring for young children and helping them grow and learn, it's really hard to build a sustainable system. So that is their number one challenge.
So, Elliot, for me, everything goes through the lens of my personal experience. And again, I'm going to go back to my daughter who pays $400 a week. And now she's a teacher and she's getting this much better salary than she was getting as a para. But in a way, a para was getting paid like a daycare worker. Okay. And she was getting paid $19 an hour. Imagine $400 a week, and yet her payment was $19 an hour. But this is why I want to share this story with you, Elliot, because when she left being a para, working with a couple of kids who had significant needs in this little elementary school, and she then segued into finally being a teacher, she's a phenomenal teacher. I mean, sometimes she's a difficult daughter, but she's a phenomenal teacher. The parents who saw my daughter leaving as a para were hysterical. And why were they hysterical? Because never had their children been given the kind of care and support they needed. Well, the reason why those kids were given the support and care they needed is that my daughter has like two master's degrees. She's worked with all kinds of children. She understands their needs. She anticipates them. I want people to understand that's how important it is to pay those daycare workers, the way it's important to pay the paras, the way it's important to pay the teachers. They all touch children and make a difference, not just in a particular child's life, but in that whole class. And just the other day, I was watching my daughter. Now she's a teacher, and she has, again, having been a para and having worked with lots of kids with some significant needs, she was in her classroom. She was on all fours with her kids, looking at some stuff that was happening on the rug where she had put all kinds of interesting things for her first graders to learn. But guess what was also happening? She had a significantly, acutely Down syndrome child, who had lots of issues. And what did she do with this little first grader? She had the first grader on her back. On her back. as she was down on the floor with the rest of the kinder, of the first graders. It was one of the most remarkable photos I have ever seen, because she knew how to bring that child into that experience. She knew how to connect with her first graders, and she made sure they were all able to do it seamlessly. You want to pay these people.
Yes.
You want to pay these people. And I mean these daycare people. And as I'm telling you the story, I'm almost start to cry because I'm like, you know, I want to be like in Finland, you know, where some of the highest paid professionals are teachers. And again, if you want a society that is going to be able to sort of compensate for all the challenges it faces, you need to take care of your kids. And then the people that do that need to be widely compensated and recognized. And I'm just hoping that the Canadian model doesn't fall apart before it gets to goal.
Yeah, I agree. I am, you know, talking to the advocates out there, I think they're hopeful, they're making progress. Obviously, what happens in their federal election is going to be a big, big challenge. It'll test the robustness, the political robustness, you know, how much is this sort of kept, is it sunk in enough? The voters aren't going to let even a party of a different, you know, ideology turned over. But you're right. Like, we have this myth in our society, that care and learning are two separate things.
They're not.
Inextricably linked. I sometimes joke that we call childcare programs like early care and education programs. You call elementary school middle childhood care and education. You could call high school adolescent care and education. You know, like we just lop off the care part, but good teachers like your daughter absolutely show care. And one of the things when we don't invest public money in childcare, in addition to having a workforce that we can't meet the demand, it turns over at stunning rates. I'm talking like programs will see 40 to 50% of their staff leave in a given year. Because again, they can go make more money at Walmart or at an Amazon warehouse. And people in those jobs should be making plenty of money as well to sustain their families. But if you have someone who has a gift for working with young children, it's a terrible loss. And for those young children who thrive on consistency and reliability and relationships, it's really bad. So, you know, I think the number one lesson in Canada, which is the same lesson that we've been taught from several other countries. There's a writer, a journalist, Annie Lowry, and she wrote this, and I quote it all the time because I think encapsulates the issue. She says, when it comes to childcare, the math does not work. The math will never work. And no country in the world makes it work without significant government investment. And that's what it comes down to. Like, we cannot nickel our dime our way out of the childcare crisis. We cannot ask parents to bear more. We cannot ask employers to solve this because that didn't really work well in healthcare, right? Like, it's going to have to come from saying childcare is such a socially beneficial service. It is so essential to family thriving, to community thriving, to economic thriving, that it should be provided to everyone. It should be primarily funded through tax dollars, and in low cost to free, ideally at the point of service. And it's such a mindset shift. But if we get stuck in this idea that childcare is some private service that only benefits the parents, it only helps them go to work, like we're never going to get where we need to get, because it does cost quite a lot of money, but it is such a good investment.
And again, Elliot, we're going to be interviewing a woman who's written about Project 2025, which is this sort of Christian nationalist approach to how America will be if Donald Trump wins. A lot of what you are saying is frightening to me, because if you look at Project 2025, their goal is to keep women home, pregnant, without access to childcare, without access to birth control, without access to IVF, without access to abortion. They want us home. The problem with us home and pregnant is that our society would crater. It would crater, because we so desperately need men and women in the workforce in order for us to thrive and survive, that it's kind of ironic. So they're like shutting all the doors. They're shutting the doors to immigration. They're shutting the doors to women. They're shutting. And so everything that you're talking about this investment in childcare is antithetical to Project 2025.
Yeah. Again, I know we're running out of time, Arnie. But I have to also tell you one secret too.
Yes.
Stay-at-home parents, need childcare also. Like,
Yeah.
I'm fine. Look, there are plenty of people, men and women, who want to stay home with their kids when they're younger. Great. Let's support them. Countries like Finland have excellent subsidized like childcare. And you know what they do? If you don't want it, if you want to stay home with your kid, they'll send you a check every month to
Oh my
help
God.
defray the costs, right?
Oh.
Because it's labor to do that as well. And Jane McCarthy breaks, right? They need to have their own social lives, their own mental health. And so that's part of it too. Like, I think we can have a comprehensive childcare system that supports all families and all of their diversity and all of their preferences and needs. It just requires putting some serious public money behind it and accepting childcare as a critical part
Public
of
money will
society.
come back in spades. It
Yes.
pays for itself, everyone. It
Yes.
pays for itself. Elliot Haspel is a nationally recognized child and family policy expert and commentator. His specialty is in early childhood and education issues. We were talking about an article I'd seen back sometime in December or January from Vox. Canada is promoting childcare for $10 a day. Could it work in the US? Of course it could. Thank you so much, Elliot, for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. This, everyone, is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We will be right back.
AIDS activist Hydea Broadbent had no choice but to be brave. I'm Bill Newman. This is the Civil Liberties Minute, and that's how The Week magazine began its recent story about Hydea Broadbent. Hydea Broadbent's biological mother had been addicted to drugs, and she had been put up for adoption. Then, at age 3, Hydea was diagnosed with HIV, and she wasn't expected to live past age 5. Hydea Broadbent's HIV developed into AIDS, and the stigma around AIDS at that time was so great that if she sneezed, her kindergarten teacher sprayed her with Clorox. Hydea Broadbent was a vivacious child, and she began speaking publicly about AIDS when she was 6. She appeared on Nickelodeon, a special with basketball superstar Magic Johnson, just after Magic revealed that he was HIV positive, and on Oprah and Good Morning America. And at age 11 in 1996, she addressed the Republican National Convention where she said, "I am the next Maya Angelou. I may even be the first woman president. I am the future, and I have AIDS." As Magic Johnson said, "Hydea changed the world with her bravery. Thanks to her, millions were educated, stigmas were broken, and attitudes about HIV/AIDS changed. We are indebted to Hydea Broadbent for her courage and activism and mourn her passing in February at age 39. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself. What's the story on Supreme Court justices and ethical standards? I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. The Senate Judiciary Committee has voted in favor of legislation that would impose new ethical rules on the members of the Supreme Court. The proposal has come about because of the recent revelations about justices having received lavish vacations and private jet trips and educational expenses for a relative paid for by politically involved billionaires, none of which did they disclose, all of which we know about only because of investigative reporting. To these revelations, various justices have responded that they broke no law or ethical rules because nothing requires them to reveal this information. And indeed, ethics laws that apply to other federal judges and members of Congress don't cover the Supreme Court, which is what the proposed legislation would change by requiring justices to abide by the same ethical and disclosure rules as members of Congress. Nothing more and nothing less. Which is a horrible idea, according to South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, who has announced that the bill has no chance in the Senate, where 60 votes are necessary to overcome a filibuster. As for the House, pundits say the bill wouldn't survive a vote there either. So, the answer to the question, has the time come for the Supreme Court to be bound to unambiguous written ethical standards regarding disclosure and transparency? The answer to that question, apparently, is no. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU. Because
when it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when your eyes are open, when you know the history, when your parents lived through things that looked so much like this, all the indications impossible to miss, when you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race, when you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance, when you know for many people this will be their last chance, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you.
it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept, locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
I ain't got no cigarettes, but 2 hours of...
Hi, this is part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Of course, we continue to record on Tuesday morning. I've heard about Project 2025. I've thought a little bit about it, but I haven't dug deep. I apologize, because I need to do that. And frankly, so do you. And that is why I'm incredibly grateful to Andra Watkins, who wrote a piece about Project 2025. She is a best-selling author who lives in Charleston, South Carolina. She writes the Substack, How Project 2025 Will Ruin Your Life. You can also follow her on LinkedIn and Instagram. The piece that she wrote at salon.com, which I am going to beg you to read. I'm going to ask you to share it with friends. I'm going to maybe even suggest that you have like a group over for coffee and read it out loud. But it is something that we need to hear, and we need to hear often, and we need to understand. Her piece is entitled, Project 2025 is more than a playbook for Trumpism. It's the Christian Nationalist Manifesto. The right intends to force every American to live their definition of a good life through government edict. Welcome to the program, and I'm really grateful that you're here. So thank you, Andra, for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me, Arnie. It's great to be here.
So when I was reading your stuff and went to your Substack, I kind of said, so like, what is it about this like New York Times bestseller that got you into like covering Project 2025? And what gives you the authority or the understanding to be able to do the kind of really incredible analysis that you're doing? And I was grateful that I asked that question. And that was because you gave me an incredibly thoughtful answer that I want you to share with my audience. And you also turned me on to an article that you had written, I believe it was for Newsweek, I think it was, last year. So before we start getting into Project 2025, I want my audience to appreciate your history to understand why you are so frightened by this and why you read it with perhaps a different set of eyes than most people in the media. And yet your interpretation and your analysis is actually essential for what Project 2025 plans to do and in fact will do, and what it means for every single American, whether they think they're a Christian nationalist or not, because the controls are going to be so intense. So Andra, explain to my audience a little bit about who you are and how you got to the place where you're now writing about this.
I grew up in a small rural town in South Carolina, and my parents enrolled me when I was in kindergarten in a Christian school kindergarten, which was very common in the 70s. In the South. It was one way to keep kids out of public schools for reasons I'm not going to elaborate on. But I stayed in that school for 13 years. I graduated from that school. While I was there, my church affiliated with the Moral Majority. That was during the rise of the Moral Majority. And so I was really indoctrinated in the front line of this Christian nationalist thinking. I was taught as a child that America was founded as a Christian nation. Our history books said that, that our founders intended for us to be a Christian nation, that as a Christian, it was my responsibility to share Christianity and stress that people needed to live Christian lives, that the Bible was God's law and that it should supersede any law that man writes that does not agree with God's law, the Bible. So I was indoctrinated that way. I went to Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, my first year, my freshman year of college. And then I attended secular college from there, and throughout my 20s and early 30s started moving away from that upbringing. I've since deconstructed that belief and really don't like talking about faith matters and my upbringing. But I had written a novel called The Evangelicals about my time in that world. It was drawn from that experience. It was not a memoir. But because my most successful book is nonfiction, it is a memoir, agents all rejected that book that I'd worked 4 years on. So an agent approached me and said, why don't you write this as a memoir and then I can sell it, because that's really how you're known and how you've had success. So at first I said, no, I don't want to talk about this that way. But after he rejected several other things, I submitted that book as a proposal. But the publishing industry decided that I still hadn't sold enough books, even though I'd been a best-selling author, to back that story. So that happened last September. I had another failure as a writer, which is common with writers. Mm-hmm. And I was at loose ends, and I picked up Project 2025 and started reading it. And I was horrified by what I found. And then the mainstream media started writing about it, and they were talking about it very differently than what I was seeing from my history in Christian nationalism, from the language that they use. And I was appalled. So I decided a couple of months ago to launch a Substack to talk about this and to pitch these ideas to other outlets and try to get the word out about the Christian nationalist language that underpins Project 2025.
My exposure to fundamentalist Christians has been pretty thin. Okay, I will be honest with you. My parents were conservative, but nothing like the way you were raised. And my parents were public school teachers. I mean, what that should tell you something. So, and then I went to a Norwegian Lutheran school, St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, but they were actually very liberal Lutherans. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so my experience has been somewhat, I know of it, I read about it, but let me just quickly share something with you. I had a young man who came to live with me for about a year. And he came through initially through Airbnb. I rent to law students, but I also have an Airbnb. And he was desperate to come to New Hampshire because he had to leave his family for a while. And I finally figured out, well, that I could put him in a room on the second floor. We could do something that's affordable. Why are you desperate to leave your family? He was homeschooled in a fundamentalist Christian evangelical house. He went to a fundamentalist Christian school where his father taught. So he literally went from homeschooling to the college in town where his father was a teacher. So the continuum of family influence, you know, never left him. And while he was at college, although it was a fundamentalist Christian college, there are people that come in that don't necessarily have the sort of incredible sort of limited experience that he had. And during the course of his time as a brilliant, brilliant engineering student, he met a young woman that he wanted to date. And the reason he wasn't allowed to date her was because her parents were divorced.
Oh, wow.
And it was the first time he had been confronted with what the reality of this limitation on what he was allowed to experience and not allowed to experience. And he was devastated. He was devastated. And his response was he fled and he got an internship in Manchester. And he said, please let me live with you. Let me live with you, because he had to run away and he didn't know what to do. And Andrew, what was so amazing to me was that for the first 2 or 3 months, he would go to work and then sit home at the kitchen table and never leave the house. And finally, I asked him what was going on. And he told me this story that I'm telling you. And I said, you are a young man. You're a remarkable young man. You are not here to stay cocooned. You are here to figure out what is life. Your parents raised you, but they actually raised you fairly well. I said, but now it's your turn to make decisions about who you are and what you want to be. Right. I encourage you to do that. So it was that story of his family and what they had done to him and why he had fled. And it was like, oh my God, what's going on here? So as I'm reading your piece and I'm thinking about that young man at that kitchen table, I'm thinking about all of us suddenly being stuck in a kitchen table, all of us being told what to do, all of us being told who to love and who we can't love. And I want this Project 2025 to be understood through the lens that you are able to bring to it. So your piece, Project 2025, is more than a playbook for Trumpism. It's the Christian Nationalist Manifesto. So talk to me a little bit about what you see as you read this Project 2025. And again, remind my audience the origins of this project, where it comes from, and why we need to understand it truly is the blueprint for the Trump agenda if he wins.
Project 2025 was initially started in 1979 by the Heritage Foundation, which is a conservative think tank. They crafted a document like this and implemented it in the Reagan administration. Ronald Reagan's administration implemented about half of their policy recommendations. It is a policy document. Mm-hmm. Over time, they have published one every 4 years, give or take. And over time, it has become more and more and more right-leaning. In the first Trump administration, they implemented about 60-some percent of the policy recommendations in that version of this document. This one is the most extreme one they have written, and it really calls for a reshaping of the whole of American government to be a Christo-fascist theocracy.
And it's helpful that let me just stop you. So it's helpful that Donald Trump now controls the RNC. It's helpful that Donald Trump does not run on any kind of policy per se. So basically it's whatever I say is the policy of the Republican Party. But Project 2025, I think, is even more lethal than even to some extent you describe, because Donald Trump doesn't give a crap about policy. He wants the job title. He wants to figure out how to monetize it and make money. And he will cede whatever policy to whoever he brings into the administration. And I think what Project 2025 is, it's not only their roadmap. It actually, I think, and to a large extent, understands exactly who they need to bring into the administration to make sure that the roadmap is followed, because Trump will not care. He's not going to focus on this. And that's exactly what they want. They want the Trump blank slate, because Project 2025 is what's going to be written on that blank slate.
Exactly. And so that's why I don't spend a whole lot of time talking about Trump. The media talks about him too much. You know, we need to be talking about the people behind this document and what their goals are, because they're very radical. And if more Americans understood that, we might have a better result in November. So I started writing about it for that reason. They start with the Christo-fascist language in the document right away. In the first few pages, they say, you know, we're going to move out upon the president's utterance of the words, "So help me God," on Inauguration Day, because as Americans, we've been given much, and as conservatives, much will be required to steward this process. That's a Bible verse. That's Luke 12:48.
Yeah.
For everyone who has been given much, much will be required. So when I saw that and then kept reading, I kept encountering those kinds of hidden references to Bible verses.
They do not respect laws. They do not respect the vote. They do not respect anything, because ultimately what will trump all those things, rule by the majority, how people vote, the kinds of rules and laws that are on the books, even the Constitution, will be trumped because they look at the Bible as the highest authority. And therefore, exactly, if the Bible is the highest authority, everything else falls to the wayside. Everything else exactly basically goes to the back of the bus, because what's driving the bus is the Bible. But it's not even the Bible, it's their interpretation of the Bible. Because there are many Bible verses that seem to sort of counteract each other, and they're going to drive through using the Bible as their form of Sharia law. Let's be honest, that's what this is. And exactly, this is their excuse for saying it's okay if people voted this way. It doesn't mean anything because it's not the Bible. It's okay if there's a policy on the books because it's not the Bible. We can ignore it. So they've already given themselves a pass to walk away from everything that sort of resembles democracy because they have a higher authority.
Exactly. And we can't question that higher authority. You know, that's the beauty of how they've set all this up. We can't ask God, well, I read this verse and think it says this, and they read this verse and think it says something else. Who's right? they've anointed themselves to be the be all end all in terms of interpreting the Bible. Christians wouldn't do that.
Well, of course not. Of course not. There, I mean, again, if you can be tolerant, you can't be a Christian nationalist, because exactly. Christian nationalist basically looks at tolerance as weakness. Okay, that's exactly. Weakness for them. So I want you to walk through, because I want to make sure I get through all this. There are what you describe as a series of four broad fronts that will decide America's future. Everyone take copious notes, okay? Four broad fronts. So let's go with promise one. Restore the family as the centerpiece of American life and protect our children. And the reason why I so love that number one, restore the family, is we actually saw it creeping in already. Because if you remember the GOP response to President Biden's State of the Union address, it took place where? In the kitchen. With yeah. a woman talking about being a mother and her children and her cross and her plunging neckline and the whole idea of, you know, somehow this is my role. And you even heard the other senator from Alabama saying, well, she wasn't there as a politician. She was there as a mother. Well, no, she mm-hmm. wasn't, but maybe that's the point. She was there to be in the kitchen, because that's the place where we're going to be basically remanded to if Project 2025 becomes the law of the land. So talk about restore the family. Give me this description of promise one.
It's so insidious, because who can argue with strengthening families, right? They talk about the difference between people's natural loves and loyalties versus unnatural loves and loyalties, and accuse liberals of subverting the family with government and their natural and unnatural loves and loyalties. And that is straight from the Bible in Romans 1, 26 and 27, where they talk about the natural use of the woman, where they believe God ordains woman's natural use to be a wife who submits to her husband and has as many children as God gives her and stays home and rears them and is a helpmeet to her husband. And that's all she does with her life. And the husband's man's natural role, which is to be the breadwinner, to be the leader of the home, to have everyone submit to him and his will. So that's how they interpret natural versus unnatural. And that's what they built into this first promise in Project 2025. They will impose this Christian nationalist view of marriage and the family on our entire society, red and blue states alike.
And let me just read again from your piece at salon.com. Everyone go there. Go and read this piece. According to their Bibles, a woman's God-given purpose is to be a wife and mother without human intervention. What do they mean by human intervention? They're not talking about a penis and a sperm. They're talking about their basis for their opposition to abortion, their opposition to IVF, their opposition to hormonal birth control. This is their foundation. Their goal is to even end no-fault divorce. You submit to the man, you stay home, you get pregnant, and anything that stops you from submitting to him and getting, you know, having children is unnatural. Unnatural. Exactly. It is just so shocking. So I want people to understand that's what they mean. That's what they, it's like code, natural and unnatural. I had no idea what the hell that was about, Andra. I'm just going natural and unnatural. What are you talking about? And then I read this and I went, oh, bingo. Of course. Mm-hmm. So again, I'm so grateful that you were reading Project 2025 with that knowledge, with that reference, and with that understanding of how to interpret the words they use. Now go to promise two. Dismantle the administrative state and return self-governance to the American people. Well, that sounds good, but maybe no cigar. So explain that one.
Well, the mainstream press has talked a lot about their plans to totally gut the federal government. But what stood out for me in that section, on page 9, they say liberals are going to be upset about this, but their outrage cannot be prevented. It must simply be ignored. And for me, that was a really critical statement, because Christian nationalists believe their interpretation of the Bible is God's perfect law. They can ignore any law that is written that defies God's perfect law. It is their job and role as Christian nationalists to force our laws to match their interpretation of God's perfect law. So they can ignore anything that goes against that as pleasing to God, They can ignore elections and results of elections. They can ignore referendums like the one in Ohio, where they started immediately talking about trying to overturn that abortion referendum because they disagree with it. They can ignore federal judicial decisions because they disagree with their interpretation of the Bible. They believe God gives them the right to ignore anything that offends God and their definition of what God's word says.
You can't emphasize this enough. Christian, again, I'm going back to your phenomenal piece. Christian nationalists believe the Bible is God's infallible law, and so it should be the basis for all laws. They will not compromise this position because they believe God commands them to follow his perfect law to the letter, which is why they are now allowed to disregard unfavorable voting outcomes. They don't care about polls. They don't care what the American voters feel. They ignore judicial decisions. They can ignore election results. They can basically justify this because they are saying if they don't serve God's commands, then we have the right to deny them. And we're kind of seeing a bit of that in Texas. Look what Governor Abbott is doing. The Supreme Court is talking to them about the border. And they've issued an order about the border. And what is Abbott doing? He's flipping the bird at them. He's saying exactly. No to them. That's the Supreme Court. Well, this is what it begins to look like. Little by little, vote after vote, rule after rule, regulation after regulation. They interpret what is God's law, and then they get to decide like a gatekeeper. Yes, no. Yes, no. But they're always right, and we are always vulnerable.
Exactly.
Promise three, defend our nation's sovereignty, borders, and bounty against global threats. Ooh, and I was talking about Governor Abbott. So describe this one.
Well, this one, what stuck out to me was how they define intellectual sophistication and how much they dislike expertise, because everything that we need to know is open for us to read in the book of human nature, to which we are all offered the key just by merit of our shared humanity. The book of human nature is the Bible. So they bury this big statement about the Bible being the basis for our laws. And Christian nationalists believe that everything we need to know as humans is contained in the Bible. We don't need any other means of enlightenment. We just need to use the Bible for everything. So this is why they dislike public schools. They dislike university educations. They dislike going to those things because they don't think we need that. We just need the Bible. And if we just had more Bible, we'd be all right.
Right. This is the basis for their attacks on public school classrooms and libraries, as well as secular colleges and universities. These are heretical places that teach humans what? To question their Bible. Oh, my God. Quickly, promise four. Secure our God-given rights to live freely, what our Constitution calls the blessings of liberty.
What stuck out to me here was their definition of what the blessings of liberty are, which is living our best lives. Now, when you say I'm living my best life, what does that mean? It means I'm having a big time. I'm going on vacations. I'm getting promoted. I'm making money. You know, I'm successful. When Christian nationalists say they're living their best life, they mean they're living a Christian life or a holy life. That's what a good life is. That's what the best life is. And so that's what they buried in this promise. They believe the founders defined the blessings of liberty as living a Christian life or a holy life.
So that means that women stay home. What that means is that women are basically perpetually pregnant. What that means is that anything that you pass in the way of a law can be ignored because then they are the interpreter of what the Bible says, therefore your law. I mean, so understand what a good life is. A good life is they decide, you follow. That's what a good life
is. It's you know, you're going to live a good life as we define it by government edict.
Andra, resubmit that book, number one, because I think if ever there was a time, and the other thing is, I don't know why John Stewart isn't calling you. I don't know why 60 Minutes isn't calling you, because again, I do think that this Project 2025, even if you didn't have this understanding that you have of Christian nationalism and just the idea of fascism and nationalism, you're terrified by what's going on in Project 2025. But when I hear your interpretation and I see your biblical references and I understand natural and unnatural, I then begin to understand that this is so much worse than what they are describing. It is so much more suffocating than what they are describing. And we already saw it on the night of the State of the Union. We already saw it. She was making crap up. She was in her kitchen. She was typically, I mean, there are pictures of that senator that I've seen before. I've never seen a picture of her with a plunging neckline until the night of the State of the Union. Did you know that? Take a look at what she wears. All of a sudden, on the night of the State of the Union, she is beyond feminine in the way that Christian nationalists define femininity. Her cross is prominent in front of her. And what she starts talking about is not her role as senator, but her role as mother. Her role as mother. And as I am reading your article and I am seeing that response, someone needs to look at her response through your lens of your definition and understanding of Project 2025 and understand why this was planned and performed through the lens of Project 2025. No one who did Project 2025 saw anything wrong in her performance. They were shamed, perhaps, but they loved it because they wrote it.
Exactly. They did.
Oh my God, Andra, it is absolutely incredible. So you have now started a Substack. Again, remind my audience the name of your Substack and how they can subscribe to it. I really encourage people to do it. And I also hope that you will come back on a regular basis because we need to not only repeat these stories, we need to add to them as we're going to begin to see more and more of the fallout. And again, I'm going to go to Governor Abbott. What did Governor Abbott do to the United States Supreme Court? He ignored them. And what happened? 12 other Republican governors came down to basically form a conga line on the border with Governor Abbott. This is not just a story of Texas. My governor in New Hampshire, governors in Florida, governors in Iowa, governors around the country are all joining together. This is not a conservative movement. This is a Christian nationalist movement. And your votes and your thoughts have no meaning. So again, what is your Substack?
It is called How Project 2025 Will Ruin Your Life. There are about 50 different entries up there right now. I take small chunks and explain how that particular chunk might impact you and your families specifically.
Andra Watkins is a best-selling author. She is writing about Project 2025. You're going to come on more often, I promise you. Thank you so much for doing this. This, everyone, is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will be schmoozing tomorrow. Ciao. Change.